purple solutions. They do not want to make all the reds and blues into happy, smiling purples. They want to keep reds and blues in their separate identities, and they say, we're not trying to change anyone's minds on the issues. We just want to change the way we see each other.
For more information on Better Angels and or the documentary, email cswallow@better-angels.org. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath.
In sports, the Brewers lost in 10 innings to the A's last night, 3-2. The Cardinals beat the Cubs 2-1. The Mets over the White Sox, 5-2. The WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Generally dry weather through the weekend. We have a slight chance of some showers and storms come Saturday afternoon. A high today around 74. By the weekend, we'll be back in the low 80s. Right now, sunshine and 64. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. Greg Berg in the morning show coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Music by the Lake, hosting Broadway television star and Tony Award-winning baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell with the celebrated Chicago Philharmonic on Saturday, August 10th in Williams Bay. Use code WGTD10 at musicbythelake.com for a special offer for WGTD listeners. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And this portion of WGTD's morning show is being devoted to one of the great cultural gems of the state of Wisconsin, and for that matter, the Upper Midwest. I'm talking about the American Players Theater in Spring Green. And my father and his wife have attended performances of the APT nearly every summer for as long as I can remember. And my wife and I are looking forward to finally getting over to Spring Green later this summer to take in one of the performances of this fine, fine theater company. And the reason we wanted to make sure to talk about American Players Theater on the morning show is because this is their 40th anniversary, or their 40th summer of performances in their lovely venue just outside of Spring Green. And I'm very, very honored indeed to have with me on the phone Brenda DeVito, who I believe is celebrating a quarter century of activity with American Players Theater. She is now their artistic manager, or artistic director. She joined them as company manager 25 years ago and has had a major hand in much of what has gone on there in the exciting history of this wonderful company, which performs between June and November, and over 100,000 people make their way to Spring Green each and every summer and early fall to take in one or more of their performances. And so we're going to be learning a little bit about the history of American Players Theater and about their present and future as well. And Brenda DeVito, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it, and that was a very nice introduction. Thank you. Yes, you must come over. If you don't come over, I'm going to hang up and not do this interview.
No, I crossed my heart, hope to die. As a matter of fact, one of the things that's kind of frustrating about living as far away as I do is
I do have actually certain commitments that take me on a semi-regular basis both to Dubuque and to Northeast Iowa. And so it's not that I don't come close to Spring Green, and I know I've come close enough to realize that it's a gorgeous part of the state and a wonderful place to do theater. We should probably explain for somebody who does not know anything about American Players Theater, even before we talk about how the company is put together, just talking about these two marvelous venues in which you present your plays.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for mentioning the area. I think the area is really important to the theater's existence. I often say there's a lot of nice places to see plays, but this is an extraordinary place to see a play. It's an extraordinary area, the Driftless area out here in southwest Wisconsin. But I think that the people who began this theater company, Randall Duke Kim and Annie Ojo Grosso and Chuck Bright, they looked throughout the whole Midwest for a site for a theater, and they looked at, after looking at like 43 different locations, including, I think, the Dells at one point up towards Minneapolis, they were looking in the Wisconsin area specifically and particularly, I think, they came on to Spring Green, and this area, this gorgeous, if you've never traveled to this part of the state, it is quite specific in its beauty, and I think that the rolling green hills and the river over here, so they went down a hillside there, and they could speak Shakespeare from the bottom of the hill, and it could be heard at the top. So they had found their like natural bowl for the theater site, and it happens to be walking through some woods to get to it. So we've maintained that. We have 110 acres of woods, and we've maintained the woods as we've made picnic areas and, of course, parking areas and all the amenities we need to do the theater. But we have up the hill an 1,100-seat outdoor amphitheater that is, you know, set under the very same stars as Shakespeare played under. And I think it's an extraordinary way to meet plays. And to also, it also adds a level of kind of, I don't know, sacredness to something. I hate to get all ooey-wooey, but there's a sacredness to walking through nature, I think, that happens when you let yourself go and you make a plan to go do something as intentional as it is to come see a play at APT. Hmm. So you park your car, you have a picnic, you walk through the woods. By the time you get up the hill, you're with 1,000 people kind of communing to do something together. It's extraordinary. And it the first year I was here 25 years ago, I had never seen anything like it. And my husband was acting here, and I sat in that audience, and I was like, what is this place? This is extraordinary. And there's just a we haven't left. We haven't left since then. So, yeah, so it's a classical theater company. We don't just do the classics, meaning what most people think is Shakespeare. And our core is classical theater. We do modern classics and more contemporary classics, which we consider to be our you know, great plays that are talking about something beyond the specific story of itself. No matter how specific that story is, it has something to say across the millennia about what is actually human inside. That doesn't change. As times change, what actually is the human existence? And I think that sounds really heavy, but you know, it's not. It's actually a beautiful and kind of safe and light-hearted way to look at the kind of the foibles of being a human being. So we really center our plays around great plays that will have us ask some of those questions and let us have some space and time to contemplate. So, like you said, we do nine plays in repertory theater every summer, so people can come for a few days and see many plays. People come from all over the country and they'll come and see, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 plays sometimes at a time, and then other people just come in and drive in and have an evening, picnic with friends, and see a play and go home. So. We kind of have a lot to offer.
Mm, for sure. I know that the very first production that was mounted by American Players Theater in that outdoor amphitheater was Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I can't think of a play that would be more ideal for an outdoor setting than A Midsummer Night's Dream. I wonder, has there been a tendency, and maybe is there still a tendency, to choose plays that, in a sense, belong in that setting in a very natural kind of way? I mean, plays that just feel right to be done outdoors? Or do you feel like when we look at the repertoire over the years, has it become a theatrical stage in which, in a sense, anything goes and it's not necessarily doing plays that in some ways might have been envisioned as being done in the open air.
Yeah, I think that, excuse me, I think that, yes, plays absolutely, like, it's fortuitous. Like, we're doing Fences this summer, August Wilson's classic. Fences, it's a masterpiece, and it's always, you know, it's very often done, and most often done inside, right? I don't know that I've ever seen it outside. But it takes place in the yard, outside the house.
Hmm.
And there's something that every set designer and every director is chasing after in an indoor space when they're doing a play that's outdoors, trying to get that vastness, that sense of, why is this play not in their kitchen or their living room? Why is it outdoors? And that sense of space and size and scope, that's what the outdoor arena actually affords plays that have massive themes and large ideas and kind of an ephemeral nature to the core of what they're going after. So, yeah, Midsummer's Dream is brilliant and was absolutely written to be outdoors. All his plays were written right to be outdoors. And I think that the size and scope of those plays, specifically Shakespeare, but also other, you know, other big works, there's just no better place than to see them outside. And if you're doing works that have crossed hundreds and sometimes thousands of years, there is something very, the alchemy of doing them inside of the scope of nature that kind of sets up this notion that they span across time, right? That people have been listening to these stories for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and that kind of communion or connection or continuum is very, very hard to put your finger on. But I do know that the sky and the tree and the moon and the stars and the sunsets and the birds and they all help in aiding in making that story feel authentic. And I think that that's a real gift that was given to us when Randy and Annie dropped this place down here, which is crazy because it's in the middle of nowhere. and who knew anyone would come? They often say, you know, if you build it, they will come. Well, lots of things have been built and no one came. I think our motto is if you build it, you tend to it, you work very hard, and you do very well, they will come.
That's certainly been the case here. Although, as I read, one of the best things on your website is where you can click on the word history and get at least a capsule summary of
yes,
these 4 decades of the American Players Theater in Spring Green. It is mentioned on that site that there was a time in the mid-1980s, so this would have been very early in the company's history, in the midst,
yes,
of its first decade, where it actually looked like it would be closing down due to financial difficulties. In some ways, from what we read there, it's almost as though that was the best thing that could have happened, because it seems as though that was a galvanizing force for those who cared about the company and did not want to see it go away.
Isn't that funny? Adversity, we try to avoid it and avoid it and avoid it, and I guess we need to, or we won't make it very far every day, but that's exactly true. I mean, I think that we look at all the crucibles and the time frame of our existence as a theater company, and in every case, it the cliche is there for a reason, is that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think that is exactly what they experienced. They experienced a kind of harnessing of what everyone that was in the incredible tenacity of the local community rallying around what was a particularly audacious dream, but understanding the value of it and the kind of special effort. And I have to say, this area is, I've lived in this town now for 25 years, and I've raised my children in the River Valley area, and it is an extraordinary community of people, and the larger, greater area of Wisconsin around us into Madison and Richland County, and it's extraordinary to me, the kind of heart and soul of the Midwest. And I'm from Iowa, so when I moved back to the Midwest and was grateful enough to land myself here, that kind of bedrock belief that if you work really hard and you come together and you get over your differences, you can actually make something great happen and move forward. And I think that I've experienced that over and over and time again in this town, not just with APT, but in the community. So, yeah, it's extraordinary. I think that those people that started the company, a lot of those people that came to our 40th anniversary party that had been here in those early days where they were asked to hold on to their paychecks,
mm-hmm,
or maybe donate them back, you know, or volunteer or run a, you know, they did everything. I have something above my desk right now that says APT needs. It's a flyer that went around the area. AP team did $151,000 to open the 1984 season. You can write a check, you can call five friends, or you can call the hotline with a donation. I mean, it literally is, that lives above my desk as a point to say that it took the efforts like that to keep this place alive, so the guardianship of this place is serious to me. And I take it very seriously.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Brenda DeVita, who is the artistic director of the American Players Theater, and they are in the midst of their 40th summer of performances just outside of beautiful Spring Green, Wisconsin, in southwest Wisconsin. And it is they are located on 110 acres of gorgeousness of hills and meadows, and they have an outside amphitheater that seats more than 1,000 people, as well as an indoor theater much smaller, and during between June and November an array of great plays are performed, and people come from far and wide to experience theater in this marvelous setting. I noticed from your current repertoire list that it appears that you have 9 plays in the repertoire, and 3 of them are Shakespeare. Is that a typical balance for APT's repertoire?
We try to do 2 to 3 Shakespeares a year, and I think that in this summer we are doing Macbeth and Twelfth Night, and I feel like we always start our season. We always start our season planning, and we will always do Shakespeare. And then we're doing a play about Shakespeare. So, yes, the Book of Will. So I feel like at the heart and soul of things, there's that old cliche that says if you can do Shakespeare well, you can do anything. I tend to believe it because I've seen it happen time and time again, because it's hard to if you've seen Shakespeare done badly and you say, I don't like Shakespeare, I don't understand it, that's completely understandable, and that's a valid answer to something you didn't enjoy. But here our entire focus is on the responsibility we have to make you understand it. And the best of actors, the greatest actors, will make you not. In fact, the biggest compliment we get is that people walk up and say, you changed all those words. Why did you change all those words? I understood everything they said. And we didn't change all those words. We just found actors who can facilitate and are really, really committed, and spent their artistic lives being great at Shakespeare, trying to understand how to convey thoughts and the kind of rigor and tenacity it takes to be great at something that takes a lot of skill. And then they also are committed to like authentic acting. So it's amazing because Shakespeare teaches us so much about acting while you're acting. I mean, he teaches us how to be a great actor, and he actually writes about actors in Hamlet, which I think is very, very fun. Whenever we visit that play, I always think, well, he knew what he was talking about. I think that the center of our seasons start with Shakespeare every time, and then we go out from there and create a 9-play season. And 8 of those plays will run in repertory, which means if you come on that every show will close down, the set will be taken up, boxed up, put back in our storage unit, and the next set will be put out. And sometimes, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then again it's 8 o'clock at night. So there's a different play on the space every day, and sometimes twice a day. There's two different plays, so it's a quite an operation. We have about 200 people that work with us, and it's a big responsibility, but it's a big operation to change out plays, and actors are in more than one play, so sometimes they'll have 2 shows in a day where they're playing completely different parts. So it's a whole different way of creating theater. It affords us a community just built right into the process of working on what we do. Because you don't just come in, do a play, get done with it, and leave. You come in and you do 2 plays at once, or 3 plays, sometimes 4 plays, and you are amidst of 35 to 40 other actors that are doing exactly the same thing. And they're on top of each other, and they're all here for 5 months. So they become, along with our production staff and our crew and our stage management staff, and become a community every summer. And it's quite remarkable, it's quite a remarkable event to come in and put those things together, get to know each other and support each other and live together and commit to doing great work together. It's a real real blessing of a community that happens.
By the way, what is this thing called the core company? When we go on the page where we see all of the photos of all of the actors who are part of a given season, some of them, including your husband, Jim DeVita, have beneath their name the words core company. And my understanding is that you were instrumental in the creation of this core company that is a very important part of APT. Tell us more about that.
Oh, thank you. I got the great honor of working with David Frank, my predecessor and my mentor, and we were talking when we first came here, Jim and I. There had been a couple actors. David had just come in after Randall had left. David Frank was the successor, his successor, and he had been handed a kind of, it was a struggling time. It was still very, very tenuous, the financial circumstances of APT at the time. And he came in, he had some actors that had stayed on after Randall left, and some Lee Ernst, Sarah Day, who's still with us to this day, Jonathan Smoots, Paul Benson, were people who stayed here when David came in the early 90s. And they were kind of artistic holdover associates. They were kind of the center of what was, he could count on them for understanding the work and the space and to be, understand how this machine works. And they stayed. And then my husband came into that in 95, playing Romeo in 1995. And we were friends with Sandy and Lee Ernst, and they had asked me to come along and be the company manager because they lost their company manager. So when Jimmy got here and I got here, there was a semblance of a group of artists that were kind of committed, because it's only 6 months a year. It's not a year-long commitment. So you would go away and do other things. It's hard to understand or define what someone's commitment to a seasonal gig would be. So we started to really talk about it because Jimmy stepped on that stage and doing Romeo, and he came home, and he'd worked everywhere around the world, and he said, I've never worked for an audience like this. And everyone talks about the audiences here, but he said, I've never, ever been listened to like that. And they lean in and make you so much better than you were going to be, because they're committed, they're here, they made this trek, they came up this hill, they brought their rain gear and their bug spray, and they're here to listen and to take part. And so he was hooked, and we had a lot of conversations this first couple of years. He's asked to come back the next year before there was an actual commitment to a company. And I started to talk with David Frank, and I started to say, you're interested in keeping someone like Jimmy here. And I don't know why David had it. He was so gracious to be listening to me. He knew I had no right to open my mouth, but he did. And I started to speak with him a lot about, we have a lot of friends that are great actors that if they just knew about this place, they would come. I mean, that's the thing about being an actor. There's just way too many actors and not enough work. And so if you know and you can go out and find those kind of needles in a haystack that would be interested in working this hard on plays kind of as an ensemble, if you could just find those people and match them up, we could make something great, as far as commitment and be able to build our seasons on those company members. And David was, keen to that. He had already started that idea, that notion, and that had been here since Randall's time. He had a company. But companies are disappearing across the country, acting companies. It's much more common to go to New York and hire your actors, go to other cities. There's so many concentrated areas to find whatever it is you need. It's hard to imagine someone wanting to live in the middle of the woods. They'll never get famous, and they'll never get discovered. They'll never get rich. And so it really is about the work and kind of the craft of acting. So it's a real, unicorn you're looking for. So he let me kind of go out and help him formulate and find those people. So my mission was to find the people who matched with our ethics and our aesthetic and our audience and the work that we do, the classical nature of the plays that we do. And it was the greatest adventure of my life. And I was an actor myself, and I acted with a lot of these people and started to really to make it about curating a group of humans, I think, that could work together and create something, and that were humble enough to do so. So, yeah, it was a brilliant time to put together. It really coincided with our growth. It really coincided with our work. You give artists home and give really good artists homes, and you tell them that you trust them and you help them get great, and you have an honest and open and committed relationship to the work, and great things can happen. It's a lot of negotiating. It's a lot of making sure expectations match the realities, and it's a lot of honesty and hard conversations, and it's a lot of joy and a lot of trust and a lot of great work that can come. So that's what we started, and now we have. And it's come. Some people have moved on, and and retired. Some people, we've added core company members since then, and we continue to look for, just this year we added our latest core company, Gavin Lawrence, who's the first African-American to join our company, which is a huge commitment for someone to come and do this work here in the middle of Spring Green. and I think that we are continuing to look for where we head inside of maintaining the great work that we do and expanding and growing the work that we do into places we don't know.
So. Hmm. Fantastic. I wanted to ask you about something else in your biography when it lists kind of the things in which you have had a major hand in creating or developing. And one of them is something about the voice and text department at the American Players Theater. I'm afraid I don't begin to understand what that even means. So what is the voice and text department? And do all theater companies have such a thing?
No, not all theater companies, to my dismay, have such a thing. no, we are, it's specific. Every company has to do what they need to do to create their work. And ours is specific to the fact that we're doing dense verbal language plays that have arcane words and arcane structures, and the rhythms and the musicality of those plays and the poetry of those plays are written with intent and purpose and have great keys inside the structure of them that makes them understandable. When, I think there's a great little clip out there. I think all these great actors from the RSC and the National Theatre in New York and out in London come out, and they're I think it's the RSC, and they're doing a, sorry, I'm bumbling around here, but they do To Be or Not to Be, and Cumberbatch comes out, and I think Judi Dench comes out, and Ian McKellen comes out, all the great English, older English actors. And they say that line, and they say, to be or not to be. To be or not to be, to be or not to be. I mean, they emphasize in what we call, which is, it's which word has the emphasis in that phrase, what's the operative. And it will change the meaning of that line. Now, if you imagine that there's, 9,000 lines you're speaking, or 9,000 lines in a play or whatever, and that every line has, or 18,000 lines in a play, that every line has a chance to be made confusing or made clear in your intent. And if you don't have a coach, I mean, I was watching this stuff about football last night, and I was like, oh my God, there's 7 coaches for that guy to throw that ball. And I think to myself, if you don't have a coach sitting with you going, okay, so let's break this down. When you hit this word or you hit this phrase, or you don't repeat that word in this rhetorical phrasing, you don't respect that end stop, you don't understand what that comma can do, you really don't understand what's all on that page quite on purpose, that you miss because you just don't see it. So it's to have a coach with you, helping you unlock the key, the kind of mystery of these pieces. Not to say this is the way you do it, but say there are clues in here to help you understand it yourself, let alone make someone else understand it. So they work very closely. They're in the rehearsal process. They coach one-on-one sessions. They're here the entire time the play is being put together. They work hand-in-hand with the director because you can guide a play, any speech to or from a certain intention. So you work with the director to find out what the story is. What's the story? That's the question all day long here, because you're saying things sometimes you're like, I don't even know what this means, let alone the story I'm trying to tell. So what's the story? And you really try to work with the director and the coach together to be clear about the story the actor's trying to tell with those words. And then you put it up on that hill in an outdoor amphitheater where now almost every place mics their actors. And we don't mic our actors. We like the natural voice. We think there's something quite essential to that in the connection of live theater. And so you have an actor that's not worked in a space that's 1,100 seats, and they need a lot of help with vocal production so they don't harm their instrument or not be heard in the back of the house. So it's a lot of technical work they work on with those actors to give them all they need to go out there and be great. So, yeah, we have an entire team of those people, which we were at the graciousness of one of our very kind of visionary in our board membership, which is Robert Burkhauser. He said, what do you need? And I said, we need a chair of this. We need someone to fund this. We need to make this a priority, or I don't think these plays will stand a chance in a time and place where authenticity and acting for the camera is very specific skill. We need to be able to get these actors to do this, which is something that's less and less likely they're being trained to do. And he helped us start the department, and it's now become just a natural part of our budget. But it's a very, very important piece of what we do and how we maintain the quality of the work that we do.
Fantastic. I think when people imagine this, and typically when one sees, for instance, a photograph of a performance in progress at American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, one sees a cloudless sky and everything beautiful. But, of course, Mother Nature has a wide repertoire of her own, and and not every night is a lovely night in those respects. Can you just say a word about the challenge that Mother Nature poses to a company like American Players Theater, and maybe even more specifically to the actors on the stage, and for that matter, for the audience? What happens on nights when it is not idyllically serene, and kind of the conditions of the evening might be a distraction to people trying to watch a play or those trying to perform a play?
It's a very good question. I think that that's also something I say I'm looking for unicorns when I'm looking for actors. Is I watch these actors. I was an actor, right? And I could not do what they do. Could not do what they do. And they're warriors. And I say that with all the respect. They are so committed to story that the bugs or the wind or the cicadas or the rain or the snow that has happened on them, they literally do not stop. They do not blanch. They do not blink. They just play with the elements. They play with the frog on stage. They play with the bats that swoop down and surround them sometimes in magical, magical moments. So the upside of nature is that she will play along. The other night we were doing Macbeth, and the sky 20 miles away was lit up with while the witches were speaking with lightning. You know, that was gorgeous and scary. And at times, during Lear, there's been stories about, you know, the storm comes and the storm comes. I mean, there's, you know, that's where you go to theater to create, and then all of a sudden Mother Nature steps in and says, here, let me help you. You know, that is a very large moment. I mean, people write us letters about that. They talk about that. That's the lore, that it's of APT that can only happen here, right, or only happen in nature. And sometimes when she's playing along, it's fantastic, like the fog rolling in the other night, you know, during the play. It's exquisite, and the moon rising above. There's nothing like it. There's no words to compare. That's why we need poets. But when she wants to, you know, decides to not play along and have us play along with her, it's another story. And I think that we have first of all, another thing, people who are warriors are the stage managers that run the shows from the booth, who are on along with someone who's on call every night. We have a person on call every night to be on weather. So the stage manager is running the show, but they also have screens up. We're on the phone with local, and we have its direct line. We are on the line with meteorologists that are in our area, and we are watching the weather continually for the safety and well-being of the company and the audience. And I think the crazy part about it is that this is the crazy part. So, yes, it will rain on you. And the audience does bring, and all of a sudden there's a moment where everyone decides the rain's starting to get a little heavy. Because if it just drips on our very Packer-like theater fans, we call them the Packer theater fans, the Packer theater fans, because they act like they're at a football game. They just come prepared. And they're staying, unless it gets completely impossible to hear or see the play. They are staying. And so our actors need to be prepared. It's kind of a dare and a challenge they put out there. And we don't stop the show unless it's dangerous or something, or we just simply can't hear, see or hear, because enough people in the audience have decided they can't see or hear. I mean, some of them would stay no matter what. We love them for that. But they come and they all of a sudden, every one moment during the show, when the rain starts to get a little heavy, they'll put on their hoods or they'll put on their jackets, and there's just a thousand people, kind of a plastic sound. And so we kind of pause, talk a little slow on stage while they're doing that, maybe repeat the line and go back at it. But often we'll play through an entire, you know, half of a show in the rain. And I know that sounds like, oh, people are like, oh, my God, why would you do that? But I promise you, the surprise of your life will be that it will be something that you feel like a kid. You feel like, I would never sit out there and watch it. And then you will. And there's something about just letting yourself sit there and focus on that story that people all the time say, I can't believe we stayed. And then we want to come back. That was amazing. That was so it's those little times when when it's, you know, when we used to run around in the rain and we used to enjoy being, you know, in the elements. And I think the people that come here are a bit of adventurers. And I marvel at them that, you know, 800 people will stay through it. A lot of times the rain will come. The other thing that we have a kind of a miracle about, we do not know why, and I wish we could study it, is that the rain will be coming, it will hit the river and it will dissipate and we won't get any rain. It'll look like it's coming, and it will just break away. Or it will rain up until 7:30 and our play starts at 8 o'clock and it will downpour all afternoon and then it will stop for the showtime. Or it will rain at closing right on their heads while they're taking their final bows. It's a very interesting, and we keep track of all that stuff. We have every night we do a rain show. We do a performance report, and we on there always discuss weather, the heat index, the humidity, if it rained, if it didn't rain, and we've kept track of those things for, I don't know, as long as I've been here.
Wow.
And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating way to look at the way a year went or not, you know.
You know, hearing you talk about this reminds me of something that I'd completely forgotten about. I teach music at Carthage College over here, and some years ago, the theater department had a one-act festival, and these little one-act plays would be done all over campus in various venues, depending on the particular one-act, over the course of a weekend. It was just great. I miss it a lot. And I still remember one-act play that involved two characters talking on a park bench, and that play was performed on what amounted to a park bench. Right along Lake Michigan there. And during the course of this one-act play, it began to rain. And we just all stood there as this one-act continued. And it was just kind of incredible because one realized that these two characters who were supposed to be in a park conceivably could have been rained on. And given the intensity of what was going on between them, that is, the two characters, they would probably scarcely have even noticed that it was raining, and we scarcely noticed that it was raining. And in a sense, that's one of the wonders of modern theater, that it has the power to transcend even some rain falling on top of you. Thank you for reminding me about that fun moment in my own theater going past.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, if it could be nice out and people won't want to watch something if it's not good. So it really does requires that the work be good. I mean, I always say there's not a lot of great places to have a picnic. Why would you come here? You know, why would you come here? You could go anywhere to have a picnic because the work has to be great. And I feel like not everything we do is perfect or great, or we succeeded in every way. But I would say that we do very well, and I think that that if we didn't, we wouldn't be here. I mean, there's no reason we would exist. It's an improbable fiction, this place, and as someone would say, and when it was created, and it's not. It's here, and it's been here for 40 years, and clearly that requires the most dedicated audience I can imagine, and artists and artisans, and I'm just such. We're so lucky. We're so very lucky.
Absolutely. So. What remains for your current season? What are the plays that people are still able to see?
Well, everything runs. I mean, once we open a play, it runs the entire season.
That's
right. We
don't
drop it out till they close. So here, so we opened those first five plays in June, and they were, we opened Twelfth Night by Shakespeare, She Stoops to Conquer by Oliver Goldsmith. It's a very, very, it's a hilarious 18th century British comedy. Then we have Macbeth, which I think is, if you like that play or ever wanted to see that play, I think this is a gorgeous, thrilling, poetic telling of that play. The Man of Destiny, which is a little known, which is indoors. Now those three are Up the Hill, Macbeth, She Stoops, and Twelfth Night. And then Man of Destiny, which is a George Bernard Shaw. We have a lot of fans who love George Bernard Shaw's work. And we did this little-known piece called The Man of Destiny, which is a witty little comedy about Napoleon as a younger man before he becomes Napoleon, and it's very funny and very smart, as you would expect from George Bernard Shaw. And then a Lovely Sunday for Crèvecœur, which is a Tennessee Williams story about like four women of a certain age at a time in the mid-1930s living together or trying to live together and create their friendships and their lives. You know, and it's a beautiful telling of a story. It has wonderful actors in it, and the design is just exquisite. Those plays are all up and running as of right now, and you can see any number of those plays any given time. And we run from Tuesday to Sunday, two shows on Saturdays and Sundays at sometimes, and sometimes we do matinees during the week. And then we will open soon August Wilson's Fences, as I mentioned earlier, directed by Ron O.J. Parson, a wonderful director from Chicago who was up here last year and directed Blood Knot for us. It's one of the greatest American plays ever written, and it's our first August Wilson, and I hope the first of many here at APT. It's a brilliant play about family, about regret, about dreaming, about failing, about, I don't know, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous play. I hope everyone comes out to see it. And then we do the last show up the hill is The Book of Will, by Lauren Gunderson, first play we've ever done by her, and it's about Shakespeare and the company of men and women around his community, around him, his plays. It's a beautiful piece. It feels like it was written for APT. It's very funny. It's very moving. It's about a community of actors. It really does. Every time when we read it, we were like, oh my God, it was like it was written for our company of people who spent their lives doing Shakespeare and wonder what that means and why they're doing it. And it's about a company of actors. So it's a beautiful play for us, and our audience will thoroughly enjoy that. And then inside, we open Doll's House by Ibsen. And that those three plays all open in the next 3 weeks. And then the shoulder season, which is October and November, we have Doll's House Part 2, which is Lucas Nath's response to Doll's House after Nora's big decision at the end of the play, what happens next. It's a contemporary kind of a take on what 15 years later means to Nora and her family. So it's a very funny play, but it's a very provocative play. I really enjoy that piece. So that's our season.
Marvelous. If people want more information about anything that we have talked about or information on how to secure tickets, what's the best thing for them to do?
Oh, please. Our website is AmericanPlayers.org, or you can call our box office. It's 608-588-2361. That's 608-588-2361, and it's AmericanPlayers.org. I think our website's really user-friendly, but if you have any questions, please, please, please call us. And right now we have a wonderful art installation. There's 7 pieces of art installed around the APT grounds right now, and they're beautiful. They were designed for our 40th anniversary. And if you haven't been out this season and haven't made it out, it's a great time. They'll be there for the next few weeks, and then they'll be gone. So we just installed them this last weekend. So if people are interested in that, it's a beautiful walk around the property to see those pieces of art. So.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, I hope when I get over there, I will have the chance to meet you in person. But in the meantime, it's been great to meet you over the phone. Brenda DeVita, the artistic director of the American Players Theater. Very best wishes and happy anniversary to you and everybody associated with American Players Theater.
Thank you so much. It's been my great pleasure always. And thank you for what you do teaching music. I love that you're a music teacher. Thank you. Take care.
And the time is 8:53. To finish out today's program, we hear about a wonderful new resource for teachers and parents of young readers. Right Brain, W-R-I-T-E. Right Brain is the creation of a professional actress named Meredith Scott Lynn. The central concept is that a youngster is presented with what amounts to a colorful children's book replete with spectacular illustrations, but where the words would typically appear on the page, there are instead empty lines, and it is left to the youngster to choose words with which to create the story itself. It is one more way, and a very intriguing way, to help youngsters break out of the common pattern of passive consumption of entertainment from a screen for hours on end that can keep a young person from creating something meaningful for themselves.
The videos that are on their phone, the games, the moving images are so comforting. You know, they don't have to go, they don't have to give anything of themselves. They have to just take it in, take in, take in. And we have to create opportunities for young people, and like I said, of all ages. We're in high schools all over the place, shockingly, but not to me. With this children's book authoring program, and it brings out the grown up in young people when you say to them, "Hey, you're 7. write a book for a child even younger than you are. Hey, you're 17. What is the wisdom? What's the joy you would want to impart, right, on a 5-year-old child who's going to be hearing your book aloud when you go to the public library and read your book to kids in the community?
And the
ownership when they receive it, because there's a digital component. And by the way, any of your listeners can go online right now to writebrainbooks.com, W-R-I-T-E. Go online. They can go to the book builder. All they do is put in their email. We don't spam. We don't send you follow-up. I haven't quite figured that out yet. They can choose a book. They could see all of the images. The book opens up beautifully on the screen. They could write on paper first. They could type into the screen. And then all they have to do is put their picture. They write a full story. They put their photo and bio in the back. And with a credit card, you can order a gorgeous hardcover book with a shiny dust jacket. It comes straight to your door. It's insane. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Can you imagine a book, Greg, sitting on the shelf of an 8-year-old's bedroom? It's a full-on children's book. Every word on every page is his title's on the front, his author's name's on the front, his photo's in the back. It's a book. It doesn't live in a cloud. It's something he can hold and show his own children 30 years from now.
Incredible.
You know, isn't that amazing?
By the way,
it inspires me every day.
What age group, by the way, are we talking about? Do you envision this for particular ages of children?
You know, I have to be honest. If you can't write at all, and we have a whole pre-K package, as long as you can talk, like my niece wrote her first book when she was 3, my niece Ivy. So did Lila. I have a little video of Lila going, I am a right brain author. She was 3 because she could talk. So we would sit together, or my mom, her grandma, or her mom, my sister, would sit with her. She would look at the pictures and tell us what to write. And we would write what she said. And sometimes we would say to help her, you know, early literacy, close looking at images. It doesn't matter as long as they can talk. And by the way, showing 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds, colorful images, pointing to things and making identifications for them, that is early literacy, right? Not on a pad, but on paper or in a book. So she would sit and tell me what she was seeing. And I would say, oh, that's good. So, but how do you think the bear is feeling? She'd say, happy. And I'd say, what's another word for happy? And she would look at me and I'd say, how about ecstatic or joyful? And she'd go, ecstatic. Now, she's 3. She doesn't know what ecstatic means, but she said it like she knew it. And, you know, later in life, she's going to have this book. So we would encourage colors and sounds and, you know, what color is the ball? Pink. And help the story become more descriptive. But it all came from her. So then now, here she is. She's 8. And she's got a library. I mean, she has a huge shelf stacked with right brain books that she has written over her lifetime. And she goes into school with all of her books to do a show and tell. She's a published author, because every child who writes a right brain book, if they go onto the website to type in their story, whether through a classroom or at home, they get a published copy. So even though it's not through the Library of Congress, we have a kid here in California. His mother bought 50 copies. He got a booth at the farmer's market, and he sat and he signed his books and he sold them. We couldn't be happier.
Meredith Scott Lynn is the creator of this resource called Write Brain. Again, W-R-I-T-E. And more information is available at writebrainbooks.com. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, NPR's Linda Holmes, pop culture correspondent, host of the very popular podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour, and now a published novelist as well. Her first novel, called Evie Drake Starts Over, has been receiving very, very positive reviews. And we talk about it on tomorrow's morning show. And on Friday, UW Parkside Chancellor Dr. Deborah Ford, along with David Brookhart, who is interim vice president of the UW system, talk about the memorable trip that they paid to Helsinki, Finland earlier this summer to give a presentation. And looking ahead, on Monday's morning show, Tony Award-winning singer Brian Stokes Mitchell, who is returning to Lake Geneva for the